You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, rags to riches, the self-made man. They're common phrases in American history. They're usually used in a positive way, virtues that help us find success. But our next guest says too much self-reliance has its downsides and that these ideas are at a toxic level in American society. In her new book, she makes the case that they limit our economy, our politics, our day-to-day lives. She calls for a more helpful future where we can be comfortable depending more on one another and, in some cases, the government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the principle of self-reliance has gone too far, or do you like that this is a big part of the American ideal? If you have lived in the U.S. and elsewhere, how do you compare and contrast our ideas of self-reliance in the United States versus other places you might have lived? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alyssa Quart is a journalist, poet, and author of books including Squeezed and Republic of Outsiders. She's executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. She collaborated with WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge on a three-part series called Going for Broke. Her latest book is called Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Alyssa, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, it's great to be here.
You've written a lot in the past about money, work, and how tough it can be to afford life in the U.S. for a variety of reasons. What led you now to tackle the idea of self-reliance?
Well, I've been running this organization, the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which I created with the late, great Barbara Ehrenreich, for 10 years, which means I've gotten 10 years worth of letters and comments from people saying, why are the people that you write about and the people who write for us, because some of our writers are working poor, why are they struggling so much? Why don't they own their house? Why do they own their house? Why don't they have a college education? Why do they have a college education? Kind of fault finding people for their own economic instability and poverty. You know, why do they have kids out of wedlock or, without a husband? Why do they have kids with different men? And there's a lot of blame and kind of moral finger pointing that I saw. And I wanted to know where that all came from.
You dug into this history. And one of the things you found is this idea of pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps that made it into the title of your book was actually originally kind of an absurd statement, a mocking statement. Some of the first examples, interestingly, in newspapers here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about the origin of that phrase?
Yeah, there was a farmer named Nimrod Murphy who newspaper article was mocking him for that he wasn't going to be able to get over the Cumberland River or a barnyard fence. And they used the straps of his boot as a joke. And then later in the Racine Advocate, they said, the governor must be trying to pull himself up by his bootstraps. And again, it was mocking somebody like, what a joke. Like you can't chew gum and walk at the same time or whatever. It was that kind of phrase. But over the decades, it became this reality. People were like, okay, I got to really do this. People are taught in school now that they're supposed to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Somebody came up to me at an event and told me that he'd been taught that in school. So we've come a long way since it was a joke in Racine.
Then there's the frontier idea where, people went out and homesteaded and settled and lived tough lives, which they did. The tough life part is pretty true, I think. But as you point out, they did it in one of the largest federal government giveaway programs ever. Could you talk about that that paradox of our frontier myth-making?
Yeah, absolutely. So, what inspired this was I was reading Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House on the Prairie and, Plum Creek and all these other, which of course, she was actually born in rural Wisconsin. So it's perfect. I'm talking to you about this in 1867. But her books were all extolling, her ma and pa, we remember them, Michael Landon in the 1980s TV show, 70s and 80s, doing it all by themselves, planting their crops. As it turned out, when you look into this, first of all, pa was a terrible farmer and he needed the help of his neighbors to, feed his family. But second of all, they got money from the federal government through the Homestead Act of 1862. So this family got a parcel of land for free. And it was one of the biggest land giveaways in our country's history. And one of the pioneer mythologies, right, is I did it. We did it on our own. We arrived by this in this covered wagon. We chopped our own wood. We built our own house. That sure, that's true. But they also got the land for free. This is not happening now.
I'm going to skip over a bunch of history and look at the present day and the stories we tell about ourselves. And you say whether we're talking about politicians or a lot of people who might look self-made on the face of it, parts of the story, parts of the biography get left out. Could you talk about our, I guess, modern day myth making?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's somebody right now who's about to be indicted, Donald Trump, who would constantly say he was a self-made man and that his father was a Horatio Alger story. But it, obviously, I mean, he was raised with millions of dollars. He'd been given a $1 million loan, right, to start a business. And, you know, he was in a huge amount of debt also, and he kept borrowing money. So he was dependent on his creditors as well. And obviously, every single person who worked for the Trump organization, and at this point, these, you know, millions of voters who follow him, and Elon Musk similarly is sort of extols doing things by himself. You know, now he owns our big social media platform, Twitter. But you know, he also got money for his research and development from the federal government, and he also came from wealth. And so I just felt it was important to keep saying, not that there's something shameful about coming from wealth, but these people were born on second or third base. And so this assumption that we're all supposed to be able to be a tycoon or a titan or run for president or, you know, just survive easily is a lie.
Talking to Alyssa Court about her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You can join in with your thoughts, experiences, or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Paul is with us in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, how you doing, Rob? Good to hear you.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Paul?
So, in my early 20s, I was a floundering, panicky, angsty young man trying to sell stereos and TVs in a store and just trying to make my way. And, you know, in our system, afraid of sort of just poverty, I guess. And I moved to Denmark, and I lived there for 16 years, and in my time there, the first thing they did when I landed was gave me a national health card, so I had free health care, and then I received a stipend until I got on my feet, which took me about a good 6 months to start being self-sufficient, and they would even supplement via aid if I needed it. My kid right now is going to college. It's paid for. Taxes are enormously high there, in our view. So if you're rich in America and you look at their tax base, you would say, this is crazy. However, when you think about how it's distributed, they don't have the angsty, panicky young people like I was. I'm extremely grateful for a social democracy, not a socialism, but social democracy.
Paul, thanks for sharing your experience. Alyssa, what do you think of his compare and contrast story there?
I love that. I mean, one thing that I found, I looked at volunteerism, you know, where people lend a helping hand, right? That's something that is always being extolled in this country and is supposed to replace the kind of social safety net the caller just mentioned. But in countries with the highest volunteerism rates, Denmark, as he said, Netherlands, Canada, New Zealand, they also have the strongest government-supported safety net. It's not a zero-sum game. You'll still be helping your fellow man, and you'll still be, you know, creating mutual care systems in your social environment if you had a better social safety net. And also, I mean, if you look at the OECD numbers of industrialized nations, the U.S. has one of the gives the least part of their GDP to daycare, at least one of the least to daycare or childcare for their citizens. And that's just another thing that there's no real reason why. And there's this idea that somehow people won't be taking care of themselves or being good citizens if they don't have a social safety net.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to David now in New Richmond. David, hi.
Hi. Say, I would 100% agree there's nothing wrong with the social safety net, but I would have to disagree kind of with the premise here. You know, my grandparents came from Germany and had nothing, and my grandfather apprenticed at the railroad and worked his butt off, became a shop manager, and my father apprenticed, became an expert in the rail industry, working at railroads, which were union-based. But here's something that my grandmother said. When my father ended up going with another railroad that went bankrupt, and he went out on his own as a businessman, and I was complaining that he was gone a lot, and this is what my grandmother said to me. There are people who let things happen, and there are people who make things happen. Which one are you going to be? Whether it's a job that you're trying to get better at or the business that he's trying to make, you have to make a decision in your life. What kind of person are you? Are you going to let things happen, or are you going to make things happen? That stuck with me the rest of my life.
David, thanks for the call. Alyssa, your thoughts?
Well, you know, it takes 10,000 hours to have mastery over a domain. It was one of the studies someone had done, and it's been proven over and over again that kind of hard work and effort and exertion is really how we become good at something. So the caller's right. It does take hard work, but it's not hard work alone. And that's just the point of this book, that it's gone into overdrive. I mean, yes, my grandparents were immigrants. They came from Poland, Hungary, Russia, and they didn't speak English when they arrived, and they became American citizens and, you know, sent me to college and money working in a shoe store. So I'm with the caller. I understand they work 6 hours, 6 days a week. But at the same time, right now, it's this kind of rise and grind mindset. Like if you go on TikTok or social media, you'll see you can they say things like 9 to 5 is for the week, or you know, you have to have lots of side hustles. And it's a really frightening version of this hard work ideology that we live with, you know, that is not, it's not really supportable, because one of the things of the messaging is that you have to do lots of different things, which is not what your grandparents did or what my grandparents did, because that kind of dissipates your energy. But they're saying you got to, you know, be a work as a physical therapist and a personal trainer, and then you have to sell CBD, and then part of a multi-level marketing scheme. It's the variety and the number of things, that gigs that we're supposed to be working, and the lack of unionization for the work that we do have.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to journalist and author Alyssa Court about her latest book. It's called Bootstrapped: Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about self-reliance, how we talk about it, think about it, practice it here in the United States? Do you have ways in your family, your neighborhood, your group of friends where you depend on each other, rely on each other? Do you feel bad when you have to reach out for help, whether it's to a friend or family member or to a government program? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to journalist and author Alyssa Court about her new book, Bootstrapped: Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Alyssa, before we go back to our callers, I want to talk sort of about the emotional side of our attitudes toward help. I'll share a very, you know, story from my own household. I've been married a long time. When I'm sick, my wife takes care of me. When she's sick, I take care of her. Invariably, the sick one getting taken care of apologizes again and again. I'm sorry. I'm such a pain. I'm such a bother, blah, blah, blah. And the other one's like, shut up. That's what we're here for. Why do we feel so ashamed, maybe, or apologetic in those moments where we might need help, even though we know we're going to offer it the next time around?
That's so funny, because I think this is what the difference between the Midwest and like a strong elbow New or sharp elbow New Yorkers, because yeah, when I'm sick, I'm like, get me the orange juice. There's no apology. What I'm trying to develop in myself, and I want others to find in themselves, I call it the art of dependence, not just interdependence, dependence. And it's really hard to learn how to either take care of someone else or be taken care of without apologizing. And to see it as an art and a craft and a skill, like something that we should be proud of. Like, usually we're ashamed of any dependence that we have, and independence is what we value. When kids, you know, climb on the monkey bars, we say, good, you're doing it by yourself. But, you know, the parts of children that are dependent and the parts of adults that are dependent are of value too. And so that's part of what I'm trying to do in this book. It's also a, I call it radical self-help. It's like to have more acceptance for ourselves when we are at our most vulnerable and needy, so we can also accept others when they're vulnerable and needy.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Heather is with us in Brookfield. Heather, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Heather?
Yeah, this is a really interesting topic because it brings me to a specific time in my life when I had just had twins. And it was interesting. I was in another state, and their state, my husband was a student and going through a master's program and working. And so we were on Medicaid, but under Medicaid, they did not even let me see an OB-GYN. They just had me see family medicine residents. The whole time I was pregnant with twins, and I didn't even see an actual OB-GYN until I had complications after the operation. And I remember standing in my apartment, and I had complications. I didn't understand them. I couldn't do the things that I used to be able to do. And my parents were there to help me, who came from a rugged line of pioneers. And my dad went to Harvard. You know, they were hard workers and instilled that hardworking aspect in me, which I lived my whole life. But up until that point, I suddenly couldn't do the things I used to be able to do. And my dad said, Heather, you need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And I knew that I couldn't. Like, that was not possible.
Heather, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Alyssa, we can be self-reliant until sometimes we can't.
Yeah, I just found that very moving, Heather, because that was part of when I recognized dependence, or both my daughter's dependence on me and my dependence on others. When I was pregnant, I was at hyperemesis the whole time. I don't know if anyone has had that, but you're sick the whole time. It's what Kate Middleton had. And you know, you become very dependent on people, something you're not used to when you're, you know, youngish. I was in my 30s, a woman. So the Medicaid story is heartbreaking that you didn't get adequate care. But I also think I'm glad that you had a voice inside yourself that said, I can't do this alone. I need more than this. And that's part of it. I mean, we can try to find the resources, try to develop them both politically, economically, and in our neighborhoods, you know, within doing it ourselves. But we also have to have that voice inside ourselves saying it's okay to need it. So thank you for sharing that.
Heather, thanks a lot for calling in, talking to Alyssa Court about her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Alyssa, you conclude your book offering some advice. There's going to be a lot of policy debates about what state and federal government might do, but you also offer suggestions about how people can build communities where people help each other. Can you share some of the practical advice you give in the book?
Yeah, so I went on a journey, really. It was during the pandemic, and I went on a journey to find alternative American dreams. And I did find them. I found them in the ways that people were organizing businesses, something called worker co-ops, where the workers own their own labor. They own their companies or the nonprofits that they work for. And I interviewed many people who belong to those. I talked to people who were part of mutual aids. I'm sure in Madison and other parts of Wisconsin, you guys had that, but during the pandemic, where people delivered food to their ailing neighbors, and it was reciprocal. It's not a charity. You may give food one day or pharmaceuticals one day, and the next day you receive it. Other forms like participatory budgeting, where citizens help decide city budgets and they sit in on meetings. Again, it's a voluntary thing. And also kind of therapy that was interesting, because right now we have a epidemic of anxiety and depression. And this was kind of mutual care therapy that was peer-to-peer therapy, where people would talk about their economic struggles, sort of like what Heather just did, as part of the therapy. And I found that very beautiful. I came up with a name for it, inequality therapy. But these are just a few of the fixes that I found, new American dreams that I found.
Do you have thoughts for us to do kind of, I don't know, maybe a self-reliance gut check and inventory to see, hey, yeah, these are ways I can be totally self-reliant and that's cool. These are ways where maybe I should let some help into my life.
Yeah, that's sort of what I've been trying to do when I've been talking to people about this. And I mean, one thing that I've done is to try to find the sources of my own strength or happiness or achievement. Think about who was behind them and sort of attribute. It's that's become my mantra rather than gratitude. I think about attribution. So, you know, the people I work with at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, my mom, my grandparents, you know, my daughter. Yeah, just all the people like you, the people that I worked with in Wisconsin, you know, that really shaped me, changed my life, teachers I've had. And that's just, it's been nice to think about creative output or work output as a collective thing rather than just done by oneself. It makes it more meaningful, really.
Alyssa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Alyssa Court, journalist and executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You can also hear the work she did with, to the best of our knowledge, on the three-part series Going for Broke. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. Plus, if you need information about changes in Badger Care Plus, we've got a couple links up there alongside that one. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're here with us on the Ideas Network. We recently received a question from Patricia Meyer from Beaver Dam as part of our Why Wisconsin project. She asked, I am curious about the history of railroads in Wisconsin, especially the early stages of rail transportation in the state. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of trains in Wisconsin? What do you find interesting about trains, railroads, their history? Do you go to railroad museums, say, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Lidke is the curator at the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
When do we start to see the first railroads coming to Wisconsin?
Well, we started to see those actually into the 1850s. The year before Wisconsin became a state, the Milwaukee and Waukesha Railroad was chartered in 1847, but they didn't fully complete anything until 1851. And actually in that time, they changed their name. It became the Milwaukee and Mississippi Railroad in 1850. And then on February 25th of 1851, we have our first train ride going from Milwaukee to Waukesha. And that was the first passenger train here in the state.
Yeah, when it comes to the early first couple decades of rail, was it more that kind of thing, passengers, or more freight, say agricultural products moving around and out of Wisconsin?
Yeah, it really was a combination of both. What was interesting, the railroad itself, that first one, Milwaukee and Mississippi, they started in February with that first passenger train, and already by April, they were hauling freight too. They had one passenger and one freight train that would run each day. And then right after that, you started having more railroads coming in. So the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific, or what we typically call the Milwaukee Road, they came up and were forming in the 1850s. The Milwaukee and Mississippi really was kind of the precursor to that railroad. The Chicago Northwestern was coming up from Chicago in the 1850s also. And then you had some other Green Bay and Western in the 1870s, Northern Pacific later on. And really, the big thing was to meet the needs of transporting agricultural goods to the east. So a lot of the wheat, getting that moved to the east. And then really with the passenger side of things, that opened up the state really for Yankee settlers to come in. You know, before that, what you're really looking at with the territory and early statehood, you're looking at the waterways for your transportation. So this was a great way to transport yourself, really, if you're coming into the area for entrepreneurial things or just relocating, and also moved in with the immigrants. So it really opened up immigration too to the state.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lou is with us in Ashland. Lou, hi.
Yeah, I'm my transport driver, and some of my passengers have said that the roads that intersect main roads, like, say, 13, the ones that are kind of at an angle that don't intersect and have sharp corners, and, you know, they'll come in kind of at an angle and then continue on the other side at an angle. And they often say that they are old railroad tracks. And I'm just wondering if there's any validity to that.
Oh, interesting. I had never heard that, Daniel. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, and some of them may very well be. It's kind of interesting, especially when you're looking at early towns being developed in our area here in Green Bay. You had the French coming in first, then the British, then the Americans. So they all set up their cities differently. So some were making their plot lines, you know, connecting to the rivers, and some were making more of a grid system. So even here, our streets, all of a sudden you might be driving north, south one way, and there's a bizarre angle because it was an old path, an old street. A lot of the railroads, too, they had to kind of navigate some of those areas by rivers, by other geographic features. So they would try and get, you know, as direct of route as possible, or the easiest route for laying the tracks. So some of those might be, I know too, when you're looking at some of those rails to trails things too, along the cities, those were all the old rail lines. So that they follow those too.
Thanks for the call, Lou, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Lidke from the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay, talking about Wisconsin's early railroad history, answering a Why Wisconsin question. We got another question from the UW-Madison Science Outreach Department on Twitter. They asked, I don't know if they're trying to stump us here, they asked, how did the railroad built in 1857 from Madison through what is today's UW-Madison campus and on to Prairie du Chien lead to the naming of the Camp Randall Stadium? I wonder if they know the answer and they're not letting on. I don't know. Daniel, do you know anything about that part of the railroad history?
Well, and that's a great question, too. The Camp Randall itself, and I will immediately apologize to most of the callers here, most of the listeners. I am not big into sports, but I am into history. So the Camp Randall itself that I know more of the history of was the Camp Randall that was formed in 1861 to meet the needs of having a place for new recruits to go and get trained for the Civil War. So Camp Randall was actually named after Governor Randall of the state when when Abraham Lincoln was pushing to get places to get recruits. So at that point it was a Milwaukee and Mississippi Railroad. They did have a line coming into Wisconsin, or into Madison rather. So that was probably the way they were getting troops, new recruits in and out of there. The stadium then, I apologize, I want to say it was early 1900s, 1917. So they still had that rail line, the Milwaukee Road still had a rail line going through to Madison. And they ran trains going into Madison. They actually had into the 40s and 50s, there was a specific train that was going from Chicago to Madison. The Varsity, and that was bringing a lot of people to the games, especially on the weekends or holiday service to the games. So Camp Randall itself was named after the governor for the Civil War stuff, and then the stadium was named after the Civil War recruitment camp itself.
Excellent. Okay, and we also had a Wisconsin question in the past. You can find it at WPR.org on the role of Camp Randall in the Civil War. So you can find a little more about that. Can you talk some about, especially in the 1800s, you were starting to touch on this, how much trains changed our lives, our daily lives, our personal lives, where we chose to live if we were Wisconsinites in the second half of the 1800s?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, with anything, when the railroads came through, regardless of what state it was, but specifically here in Wisconsin, when you're looking at the early railroads, with the first railroad, you know, got our first ride in 1851, you had about between 20 to 40 miles. And already by 1880, you've jumped from that 20-mile mark to having over 3,000 miles of rail in the state. So all the railroads coming through and investors in the railroads, entrepreneurs, you know, seeing the value of this new source of transportation, you know, and that continued well into the 1920s, really was the height of the industry. And then we see a decline. But you're bringing people in not only for work, for, you know, building their new lives, for coming into the state, and then you're kind of getting into this, you know, what we think of more today with using the railroad for more leisure activities. So you've gone for it really being primarily the industry for moving goods or moving people, that's starting to get it as more of transportation, vacations. Going back to the Camp Randall thing, sports trains, you had sports teams riding on these trains. You had it bringing people up to Green Bay for games, to Madison. So it really changes. Even hunting, there would be hunting excursions on these trains on the weekend going up to Loretta, up in Ashland County, Star Lake, Wisconsin. So you've got specific trains, Fisherman's Special in the Northwoods, Hiawatha, bringing people up to go hunting and fishing. So it really changed not only bringing people into the state, but how we moved around within the state.
In just our last minute or so, Daniel, can you share one of your favorite or most recent exhibits at the Railroad Museum? I've enjoyed visits there, and my kids certainly did a lot too.
Yeah, this is actually perfect because we have an exhibit right now called Rail Ties, and it's focusing on community stories. So it's really looking at people who either worked for the railroad or had families working for the railroad or had experiences that might be interested in telling us their story, to give oral histories here at the museum, or to, you know, if they want to loan an item and they have a neat story, whether it's a picture or an object, because we really want to preserve that history, both with the oral histories and the objects themselves. But we also want people to realize, you know, trains aren't just those things that you get stuck at by the crossing when you're watching all these freight cars go by. It had a huge impact and continues to have a huge impact on the state. So yeah, our newest exhibit, Rail Ties, really is trying to get that community engagement and involvement here with the museum, both now and continued.
And briefly, Daniel, if somebody says, yeah, I have a story or an artifact to share, are you still looking for those?
Yeah, absolutely. We started the exhibit at the beginning of the month here, but I'm going to be rotating things out throughout the year. And again, we always want those oral histories too. So any of those items, so they're welcome to contact me here at the museum.
Daniel, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Daniel Lidke, curator at the National Railroad Museum based in Green Bay. He joined us to help answer a listener question for the Why Wisconsin Project about the history of trains in the state. We're done riding the rails, but come up, we'll hike and bike on them with a look at rails to trails projects here in the state and beyond. That's next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We just learned about the history of trains in Wisconsin's early years. Staying on track, we're going to answer two more Wisconsin questions related to trains and railroads. Some railroad lines aren't railroads at all anymore, but we can still use them to get around. For some of those abandoned or otherwise removed railroads, they might get turned into a trail system. Typically referred to as a rail trail or rails to trails, these old railroads now offer a place for people to hike or bike. We recently received a couple of questions from John Hansen and Phil Kasnowski from Medford and from Madison. They asked, why was the first rail to trail in the nation developed in Wisconsin's Elroy Sparta area? History, people, groups to thank, how can it be expanded? And also about the history of the rails to trails and or other trails in the state. Earlier today, I got some answers to those questions with Eric Oberg, Midwest Regional Director of the Rails to Trails Conservancy. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, Wisconsin, pretty prominent figure in the rail to trail movement. We've got the first one, as I understand it, the Elroy Sparta Trail. How big a deal was this when this first rail in the country, first rail to trail in the country got started?
Yeah, it was huge, right? The rail trail movement really started just a bit south of you guys in the Chicago suburbs. And there was a school teacher, Mary Teelgard Watts, in the 60s that wrote a letter to the editor posing the proposition that the railroad track in her community be turned into a place for people to get out and walk and have a place to go. And that really kickstarted it. Elroy Sparta became the first developed rail trail. It was really just a really good idea that happened to meet a perfect time. But it was a slow burn at the very beginning. It's not like it exploded right off the bat, but humble beginnings and in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, in Illinois.
Now, one of our Wisconsin question askers was curious about why that Elroy Sparta Trail, in fact, was converted into a trail. Was there something about that stretch that made it an attractive first developed trail?
Well, it's interesting, right? I mean, I'll start by saying that this movement started really slowly, you know, Elroy Sparta being the first one. And it took almost 20 years for Rail Trail Conservancy to be founded in 1986. And at that point, there was still only 250 miles of rail trail, which may sound like a lot, but today we have over 25,000 miles of rail trail. So what Elroy Sparta did was essentially prove the concept, right? And it was not the easiest thing. If any of your listeners that have been out there, it's the reason it's so wonderful. The tunnels are just unbelievable. But of course, tunnels and bridges are also big, expensive, and complicated pieces of infrastructure. So if you were to think about trying to create the first rail trail, while Elroy Sparta is undoubtedly one of the coolest and most beautiful, and those bridges and tunnels are awesome, they're also really difficult. So it wasn't the easiest, but it was the best, because it gave people that, you know, when you went out, the people that finally got to go out and see what a rail trail was like, if they went to Elroy Sparta, they were blown away, right? It's really cool. So it wasn't the easiest, but in hindsight, maybe it was the best.
Now, if you've ever tried to walk on a railroad track, it is not pleasant. Biking, less so, I imagine. What does it take? Can you talk about just the efforts to take a length of track, forget the tunnel and bridge for now, and turn it into a trail?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say it's easy, but I will say these corridors were engineered by, you know, the best and the brightest of their day, right? But these railroads really were the cutting edge of transportation when they were designed and engineered and built. So when you think about what they were built to do, to carry tons and tons of train and car, you know, of railroads and cargo, they make the perfect base for a walking and biking trail. And so you have a lot of the elements that you would need for a trail already in place, a wonderful substrate, you know, that all of that heavy rock and everything that they needed for a train is perfect for, it's over-engineered for a walking and biking trail. So it's just and maybe the most key thing about it, they also went from somewhere to somewhere, right? The railroads weren't building trails they weren't building rail corridors because it was beautiful country and they just wanted to see neat things from the, you know, from the front of the train. The engineer didn't, they needed to get things from a place to a place. And that's the beauty of rail trails now. They certainly go through beautiful country, obviously, but they also connect people and communities because that's what the railroads did.
One of our Wisconsin listeners mentioned that within months of moving to Wisconsin, he felt like his local rail trail out of Medford encouraged him to explore his new city and go bike riding. Can you talk about the benefits and how this gets people in many communities outside?
Yeah, I love it. And one of my favorite, sentiments about rail trails was something that one of our founders at Rails to Trails Conservancy said, David Burwell. His dream was that rail trails would become America's main street. And that bit of nostalgia about what Main Street used to be, where, you know, families and people would be walking down Main Street and saying hi to each other. And it really was the place where community happened, right? And we've kind of designed and suburbanized ourselves out of that Main Street community. And trails really have become, trails that go through around communities have become a place where community happens. And so that listener saying he gets on his bike and you know, really enjoys the community he's in, it's because that's where the community is. You're seeing young people, kids, families, old people. You're seeing folks walking, biking, mobility impaired with a wheelchair or otherwise. I mean, every facet of your community is out using that trail. And unlike in your car when you pass people, if you pass people on a trail, it is a personal experience. At the very least, you smile at each other. More often than not, you say hello. Maybe you stop to have a conversation. It's the place where community happens now.
Another listener question. A listener's curious to know if Wisconsin's current rail trails, including Elroy Sparta, could ever be expanded. Do you have your eyes on any trail expansions, especially in Wisconsin, in the works?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most exciting evolutions of the trail movement, and really the evolution in the way that Rails to Trails Conservancy and our partners do our work. We have gone from helping communities and states and otherwise develop individual trails, some of them really long, like Elroy Sparta. But because of the success of the movement in the last 50 years, we're now looking at connectivity. How do we connect these long trails to each other? How do we connect trails in more urban areas into networks that really allow people to move through these urban areas and get to get to places they want to go? And one of the great examples of that in Wisconsin is what we call the Route of the Badger. And Route of the Badger is one of our Trail Nation projects, a small suite of projects around the country that we are really trying to help prove this connectivity concept and show people how to do it and work with people on doing it. And Route of the Badger is in southeast Wisconsin. We're talking Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, Waukesha, where there's already 350 miles of amazing multi-use trail. And the goal of this project is to connect everything together into a 700-mile seamless network. And it's the number of nonprofit and public agency partners that have been working on this with us for years now is astounding. And the progress has been great. And when you look at a map of Wisconsin, there's a lot of metro areas where this connectivity work, is already in progress, but there's also such huge potential for connecting some of the long distance corridors. If you look at a trail map of Wisconsin, a multi-use trail map, it is not at all hard to see that there's a real opportunity to connect the lake, the lakefront in Milwaukee. It's almost all the way connected to Madison now. It's really, really close. And then from Madison, you can see that there's already some long distance trails, including the Elroy Sparta, that would eventually get you up to La Crosse. And you think about a lake to river corridor from Milwaukee to La Crosse that would cross the entire state of Wisconsin. What an amazing amenity for the people in Wisconsin, but also what an amazing amenity for people all over the world would come and use something like that.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Eric Oberg, Midwest Regional Director for Rails to Trails Conservancy. He talked with us about the history of Rail to Trail in Wisconsin and the Elroy Sparta Trail, the first one in the nation. This conversation came from multiple audience questions as part of our Why Wisconsin project. Do you want to know something related to Wisconsin? Submit your question and we might tackle it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's W-H-Y, Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.